What do you think of the term politically correct?
Well, as you know, in my book, I talk about it extensively, and I share with people where it actually comes from, because most of the people who are politically correct have absolutely no idea where the term comes from, what the origins of it are, what the origins of the concept are. And of course, most people in my experience in the United States, in the UK, in the entirety of the West, don't understand that in accepting political correctness, they've actually imbibed the dogma of the early, not even the late, but the early Communist Party in Soviet Russia, because this is something that was used essentially, and political correctness, people should know this, never had anything to do with preventing offense, with being kind, with being generous, with being respectful towards minorities. Political correctness never had anything to do with any of that. The point of political correctness was that so the people in the Soviet Union could say, "Well, comrade, what you're saying is factually correct, but it's politically incorrect." In other words, it was a way of ensuring that the party line could not be challenged. And so when we talk about political correctness in modern Western society, increasingly, to me, what I see is that is the way that the speech codes and the intolerance of different opinions and expression of different views is being used in that way. It is being used to say, "Well, look, we don't care if what you're saying is factually true. We just care that some people don't like you saying it, and therefore you shouldn't be allowed to say it." And the point I make in my book, and the point I've always made, is, look, you can structure your society any which way you want, but this is something that in democratic countries like ours pretend to be, is supposed to be determined by the votes of the people. I don't know many people who voted to have speech codes in American society. It seems to me counterintuitive to the entirety of the American project, which is based, if you think about it, the reason the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and it is primary, and it's important to the maintenance of American democracy. That is, political speech should be free insofar as it's possible. Otherwise, you can't really have democracy. And so a lot of the conversations that we have around that issue seem to me to be missing the point, which is that we've bought into an ideology that is completely alien to the Western way of doing business, and to the way that we've structured our societies. And we've done so by incorporating the attitudes and the values of a completely different society with a different culture and a different history, which is Soviet Russia and later Maoist China. These do not seem to me to be the types of societies that we in the West should emulate.
Yeah, and in the book too, you mentioned that this sort of control of language, it can even at first look like it's something to help people, but in the end kind of come off as more predatory almost.
Well, right. I mean, this is how the entirety of this restriction of people's speech has been used. It's a way of saying to people that we're going to look after minorities, we're going to look after this group, we're going to look after that group. But as you see the practical consequences of it down the line, you recognize, I think, inevitably that quite often the things that we're not supposed to talk about are the very things that need to be talked about in order that they can be properly ventilated, challenged, questioned, that the right questions get asked. Because what happens if they don't is, take the issue of the transitioning of children, for example, even adults. We just interviewed yet another person who is detransitioning because of what they were rushed into. Well, part of the reason that that was able to occur is that there were certain dogmas that could not be questioned without you immediately becoming transphobic, being banned off Twitter, being banned off social media platforms, etc. And therefore, there was not enough pushback against some of the things that were happening. And that is because there are some people in our society who deliberately conflate a quite legitimate questioning or skepticism about certain progressive dogmas and viewpoints with prejudice and bigotry and whatever, because it's an easy way to dismiss the very important arguments that are being made by the people who disagree with you. And so that's one of the ways. The other way, of course, as I talk about in the book, is if you change the meanings of words, you can change what laws mean. Because if you have a law that says that people must be free from violence, people must be protected from violence, well, that is a law that in the conventional sense means that you are supposed to ensure that people are free from physical harm. that's what violence means, physical harm from another person. But if you change the meaning of violence to someone saying something you don't like, well, a law that is that was implemented and designed to protect you from being physically attacked can now be used to enforce speech codes on people who say things that you don't personally like. And so simply by changing the meanings of words that already existed, you can change the meaning of legislation without, again, coming back to my point about democracy, without ever having to have an election to determine that this is what you want to happen. And so it's a way of changing the rules by which we play the game without ever consulting the referee.
Yeah, there's so much power in language. And I was kind of meditating on this with a friend as I was preparing for this interview and talking about that political correctness and the predatory side of it. And I didn't quite understand that. And then he told me a story from his own experience that kind of made it click for me. He was 17, and so he's a kid, but he's in this place where he's working as an usher. So he kind of has a little bit of power to let people go at this sporting event, and people are coming and going. And at one point, people run across the space when he's supposed to tell them to stop, and they're not listening. And a woman near him, an older woman, says to him, "Oh, they're so retarded." And in that moment, she was trying to kind of support him and say, "They're not listening to you." But he saw this as a chance to put that woman in her place and say, "Oh, I don't use words like that." And he actually ended up taking her down a peg and kind of using his power. And he said at the moment, as a 17-year-old boy, that was really intoxicating. And then afterwards, he realized, wait a minute, that was me just being a jerk and taking that woman down. But there's this excitement about the power of language that's really hard to let go of.
Mm. That's a really interesting story. And I think power is exactly the right word to talk about, because power and status is something that all people crave, men more than women, but particularly men, and everybody really wants to have influence and power. And power and influence and status are intoxicating. And this is one of the reasons that these ideologies have taken such a strong root, because it's an opportunity for people who otherwise have no power whatsoever, because they haven't built anything, they haven't created anything, they're not people who've started a company that's become successful or made a scientific discovery or created some kind of new form of technology, or people who've led a social movement, or people who've achieved anything in any meaningful way that other people around them would recognize and go, "Oh, you've done all these things that benefit us as a human society. We therefore confer upon you an amount of status and an amount of wealth that corresponds to your level of contribution," because that's how the market works, right? Mostly, if you create something that other people value, whether that's a podcast like yours or a book or whatever, people are either going to buy it or not based on whether they think that you've created something of value for them. But what do? If you don't want to do any of those things, if you sit on the sofa at home, spend 23 hours a day on your computer, well, one of the great things you can do is criticize other people for saying the wrong thing, and you now have power. You can end careers. I mean, it is genuine influence and power that you can get by short-circuiting the system, where in the past you would have had to work, you would have had to prove yourself, you would have had to create things, you would have had to sacrifice and go through challenges and difficulties. All you have to do now is, you know, tweet, "This guy's a transphobe," or whatever, and suddenly you've got loads of power. This woman is in this case of your friend. No, she said the wrong word that up until 30 years ago, everybody knew meant someone, you know, used to mean somebody's not being clever. Someone's doing something stupid, as we all do from time to time, right? Now, that's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for your friend to assert himself, to be morally an upstanding citizen, as if him doing that is going to save one mentally disabled person from discrimination or some kind of mistreatment.
Yeah. So as we get wrapped up in this culture war in the West, how do you think that affects our ability to influence things in the world, particularly now with the war in Ukraine?
Well, I am one of the people who's on record saying from not only after the invasion, because it was very easy for a lot of people to predict things after they happened. That's what tends to happen with predictors. But I was saying for a long time, many, many years, that if the West continues to distract itself, to take its eye off the ball, to spend its time talking about things that are unimportant and irrelevant and distractions, than other hostile actors. And this is the one thing most people forgot, because we live in this airy-fairy, everything's wonderful world. I imagine you as a military vet would understand that this isn't the case. But we have enemies. And the primary way of preventing people from going to war with each other is that they know that the other side is not to be trifled with. This is a thing that we know since Roman times, civis pacem parabellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. That is what I imagine. I never went to a military academy. I imagine it's one of the first things they teach you when you go into that line of work, right? And that's because it's universally understood that, you know, different empires and powers will push against each other as they perceive weakness, as they perceive opportunities to strike, as they perceive opportunities to expand or challenge the dominance of the other side. And so it was always very obvious to me that if the West continues to distract itself and take its eye off the ball, we would leave ourselves exposed. Now, I said in 2014 that given the West's pathetic response to Russia's annexation of Crimea and the mess they started in eastern Ukraine, they would come back for more. Sadly, I've been proven correct. But I actually thought that the threat was much more likely to be coming from China, because, as you know, the Chinese, for example, if you look at something like TikTok, well, they pump out all this woke stuff for the English-speaking audience. The Chinese version of TikTok is nothing like that. It's all traditional values, masculinity, you know, all of that good stuff, because they know what they're up to. And the Russians the same. The Russians want nothing more than for us in the West to spend our time talking about pronouns. And to the extent that they see us doing that, they perceive that as weakness. And I think one of the reasons that the war in Ukraine happened was that the Russians felt, the Russian leadership, not the Russians, the Russian leadership felt that with Donald Trump no longer in office, and I had many criticism of Trump, but the one thing I think was clear, this invasion would never have happened if he'd still been in office. So in that way alone, you know, the fight back against wokeness and the excesses of Trumpism, those two things combined caused Russia to be able to invade. But then also they look around and they go, well, you know, the president of the United States spends more time talking about things that don't matter than talking about national security. Well, maybe this is the right moment for us. So I think it's no surprise that China is becoming as belligerent as it has been. And I think it's no surprise that Russia invaded when it did, because the West has spent quite a lot of time undermining its own values, undermining its own strength. I mean, you'll be familiar with this, of course, comparing American and British military commercials versus Chinese and Russian ones sort of gives you enough of, I don't know if you've seen these, but you know, the British and American ones are all about, you know, some minority community now thankfully being integrated into the military, and the Russians one are all about, like, you know, you can go and fight and win and defend your country and all of these things. You know, those things contrast very well. And by the way, I think Vladimir Putin massively overestimated how distracted the West has been, because the pushback has been stronger than he thought. It's been stronger than I thought. But the signaling has been terrible. And if you keep signaling weakness, sometimes people are gonna try their luck with you.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think things end in Ukraine?
I think that at the moment it's completely impossible to say, because it really depends on what happens over the next few months. The conflict is very much in the balance. You could slice it different ways. People could say, well, you know, Russia controls, you know, whatever percentage of the territory it's captured. Still, I think that's true. I also think if you look at the trends over the last few months, Ukraine has taken back a lot of territory. And by the way, most of that territory was never actually won by Russia. What happened is they essentially managed to steal most of it using collaborators, traitors in the Ukrainian armed forces. So the area in the south, for example, that the Ukrainians recently liberated, the Kherson area, they never had to fight for that. So they captured a lot of territory without having to fight for it, and then lost a lot of it by being defeated in conflict. So the trend is not helpful to Russia, but I think the future of that conflict depends almost entirely on how much help the West continues to give the Ukrainians, because you've got to understand Ukraine is a smaller economically and militarily and in every other way country than Russia. So the trend would be towards Russia over a period of time benefiting from a long-running war. But Ukraine has a lot of support from the West. I think it depends almost entirely on how that part of it goes. If the West provides the weapons and the financial support Ukraine needs, the Ukrainians could very comfortably push the Russians out of certainly eastern Ukraine. Crimea is a different story, because I think once you start messing with that, my opinion is, and you know, I there's nobody who's more in favor of Ukraine being able to maintain its independence than I am, and they are without question the aggrieved party in this conflict. However, it wouldn't be wise for Ukraine to attempt to recapture Crimea. I honestly don't know. And the level of escalation that might cause may not be worth the trouble for Ukraine, in my opinion. There'll be a lot of people who disagree with that, but that is that's been my opinion from the start of the conflict. I actually at the start of the conflict said that, you know, the Ukrainians need to fight and give Russia a bloody nose, and then they would have to give away things that they don't particularly care about, and I think Crimea is one of them. Crimea has way more importance for Russia than it does for Ukraine. For Russia, it's the port from which it can host its Black Sea fleet. Ukraine doesn't have a fleet, and the territorial importance of Crimea is significantly less. So it's more of an ideological, you know, recapture all of our territory, which of course is understandable. But you know, I think Ukraine could very easily, quote-unquote, win the war. We've seen that Russia has absolutely no intention of using nuclear weapons under any circumstances. And despite defeat after defeat and setback after setback, there's no risk of that happening. But, you know, my only worry is what will happen with Crimea. Equally, though, if the West doesn't provide the support that Ukraine needs to carry on winning, then, you know, it could go in a very different direction as well. So I think the conflict is very much in the balance, and it would be extremely unwise to make predictions. One thing that I think the Russians attempted to do, and I think they will fail ultimately in doing so, is they wanted to wait until winter to see if they could peel off some European countries on the basis that, you know, we in the West, in Western Europe, need their gas, and without their gas, we can't survive. I think that is turning out to be a false hope for Russia. They're not going to be able to peel Germany and France off the anti-Russian coalition that's now formed. I think the ball is very much in Ukraine's, in Ukraine's and the West's core. It just remains to be seen what they do about it.
Hmm. You said that there's almost no risk of Russia using nuclear weapons. It seemed for a while that was a big part of the narrative that people were looking at. What makes you come to that conclusion?
Well, if they wanted to use, whatever red lines you can have for Russia using nuclear weapons, people said if the Ukrainians started retaking lots of territory, the Russians would be forced to use nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Well, they've retaken lots of territory. It hasn't happened. The people said that if naval bases or military bases or other military installations in Russia were attacked, then Russia would be forced to retaliate. Well, military installations in Russia and airfields in Russia are being attacked daily at the moment. Russia hasn't used nuclear weapons. People said that if the West provided more support, for example, Patriot missiles, which are currently on the way to Ukraine, that would be seen as a sign of escalation by Russia that would lead to them considering the use of nuclear weapons. Again, there's no sign of that whatsoever. Russia's position on the use of nuclear weapons is very clear. If NATO forces were to attempt to invade Russia, at that point, they would consider using nuclear weapons. If NATO or anyone else attempted to nuke Russia, they would retaliate with nuclear weapons. And you've got to remember as well, that there was this big conversation, particularly on social media, especially on Twitter, about how, you know, Elon Musk and David Sachs and all these people were like, we must stop the nuclear war. And then Elon Musk bought Twitter, and suddenly I was just talking about Twitter and no one cares about nuclear war. And so it makes me think that, you know, our social media are just a big distraction machine for people who want to put their minds to something important and creative. And so they go on there and they go, okay, what's the issue? The issue is, yeah, nuclear weapons. Okay, cool. Let's talk about that. And they talk and talk and talk. And then a more interesting distraction comes along. And you will have noticed this with media coverage as well. There are times when Ukraine is front page news, and then there are months on end when no one says anything about it. Now, in that period of time, the risk, if you believe there's a risk of nuclear escalation, doesn't go down. The war is ongoing, right? The war continues. It's not like they all take a break and go and have Christmas. The war is still going on, but no one's worried about nuclear escalation. And I think the reason for that is that people just want a distraction. I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that Russia would seek to use nuclear weapons in retaliation for Ukraine winning or Western support. We've seen that consistently, including with statements that they've made. You know, Russia keeps talking about how they have a right to defend themselves. And the more wacky out there commentators keep talking about how we've got nukes. But anybody sensible in Russia is saying very clearly that that would be silly. And don't forget, Russia keeps pretending that the territories that they are conquering are Russian territory. So if this is your land, why would you drop a nuclear bomb on it? It doesn't really make sense. And that is, again, something that a lot of people in the Russian leadership have said many, many times, that the nuclear escalation is something that they don't want. I've seen no evidence to the contrary. So I think that was something that a lot of people in the West, particularly in America, if you American viewers and listeners will forgive me for saying this, I think, you know, my experience, as you may know, we were in America doing a bit of a tour. We were on Joe Rogan's show, and a British friend of mine who lives in America, who you'd know, but I don't want to publicly out him as having said this, but he said, "Constantine, I got to warn you, they don't really understand what's going on in Ukraine in the US, and they don't particularly want to. They just want this problem to go away." And I think, I hope people will forgive me. There's no doubt many extremely well-educated people in America who understand what's going on in Ukraine. I'm certainly not tarring all Americans with the same brush. But in the broad sweep of society in the United States, it seems to me like there's a lot of people who don't really understand the nuances of what's going on. But understandably, they don't want their country embroiled in a foreign conflict with the risk of nuclear escalation. And that's where a lot of this narrative is coming from. I think most of the people who understand what the situation is on the ground understand that that's not likely at all. I said at the beginning of the conflict that, you know, people said to me on Question Time, which is the biggest TV political discussion show we have in this country, they said to me, "Do you think if pushed, would Vladimir Putin use nuclear weapons?" And I said 100%. But what I mean by if pushed is like his life is in danger. If there's like an American assassination squad making its way through the streets of Moscow to the Kremlin, at that point, he may consider using them. Doesn't necessarily mean that they would get used, by the way, because I don't think there's many people in Russia who have an appetite for everyone on the planet being killed to protect one man. But those are the circumstances in which that they may consider that. Apart from that, I don't really, or an invasion of Russia or a nuclear attack on Russia, I don't really see any evidence whatsoever that is likely to happen. And so because of that, I'm deeply unconcerned about Ukraine continuing to retake territory and the West's help in doing so.
So you mentioned maybe people who are trying to follow this being distracted by things in the Twitter space, or maybe just not being well informed. How could people, particularly in America, become best informed about what's happening in Ukraine?
You know what? I wish I had an answer for you, because it's a frustration of mine that the conflict is not being well covered. I write on my Substack as much as I can about the conflict to give people a broader picture view. That is really the difficulty, because we live in this media landscape now where the mainstream media are just interested in a short clickbaity type of stuff that there's no substance to. It doesn't really explain it. And then you're sort of in this alt media environment where you have absolutely no idea what, you know, okay, some guy in America who used to be a comedian who's never been to Russia or Ukraine, doesn't speak either language, but has a big audience. He now has a great explanation of what's happening in Ukraine. And you're like, well, do I believe that? Well, he's been right about woke stuff, let's say. I'm sure he's right about this. And so you get this alternative media echo chamber in which the being against the current thing, being against what the mainstream media is saying, becomes the currency, right? And people cling to that. And this happens to be one of the issues on which that alt media echo chamber is completely deluded and deranged and doesn't understand anything about what's going on, and has swallowed Russian propaganda wholesale because it matches their biases. It happens to be the one of the few issues on which the mainstream is broadly accurate. I mean, I think they go off the deep end in certain areas and trying to, you know, paint Vladimir Putin as, you know, the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler and all of that. But broadly speaking, I think the mainstream has got this one correct. And that is very uncomfortable for people whose entire livelihoods and existence and raison d'etre of the last many years exists on the basis of, well, we oppose whatever the mainstream media is saying because the mainstream media lie a hell of a lot. So I wish I had a more satisfying answer than read my Substack and, you know, try and inform yourself from other sources, people who speak languages that are relevant, who understand what's going on the ground, who can give a better perspective. Yeah, I wish I had a better answer, unfortunately.
Well, how do you do it? What works for you?
What works for me is I have a lot of contacts on the ground in both countries, in Russia and in Ukraine. I have a lot of family there. I also am able to access pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian commentators, Telegram channels, media, etc. And if you look at something like the pro-Russian ones and the pro-Ukrainian ones, if they're both broadly saying the same thing, that thing is likely to be true. If they're just if you're just listening to the stuff you want, which is the pro-Ukrainian or the pro-Russian, you're not getting an accurate picture. So you have to be able to read the information in the source languages, speak to people on the ground, and then work out for yourself what seems to be accurate, who has a strong predictive track record, which is not many people, and try and base it on that sort of information.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you have contacts in Russia. You're born there. What would surprise Westerners about Russia? Maybe folks who haven't been there aren't familiar.
Vladimir Putin has a massive support from the Russian public in this conflict. I don't think that's going to change. I don't think that's going to change certainly in the short term, even if there are setbacks. The Russian mentality is such that once you have a strong leader, you back him to the hilt. And it's only once he's been removed or he's died or passed on, then you can go, oh, Stalin was actually quite a bad guy. most people cried when Joseph Stalin died. It was only after he was exposed for the personality cult that he was, and the terrible atrocities that were committed under his leadership, it was then that people turned on him. And I think it will be the same with Vladimir Putin. He will remain popular until the day he's no longer in power, or he's no longer alive, which is probably the more likely way of him no longer being in power. I think that's one of the things that would surprise people, because I think people in the West think that, oh, you know, the Russians must be getting fed up of the conflict and whatever. And I'm sure they are to some extent, but they will continue to support Vladimir Putin as long as he's the leader.
Mm-hmm. To talk a little bit more about your background, too, you wrote in your book that your grandmother was born in a gulag. For those who don't know, what's a gulag and how does that happen?
A gulag is a concentration camp primarily for political prisoners. That is, people who expressed criticism of the Communist Party or made a joke about the communist leader at the time or something like that. People who had the wrong opinions, the wrong thoughts, wrong think. And also there would be some common criminals who would be sent there as well. So the gulag system was a system of these camps built all around, particularly the worst, you know, in terms of environmentally, from a climate and, you know, human sustainability perspective, human survival perspective, worst parts of Russia and the former Soviet Union. They were often used, the prisoners themselves were often used to do the most hazardous and dangerous and high risk work that could be done, logging trees in the middle of Siberian winter, mining, you know, metals in horrible conditions, that sort of thing. What was the second question? How did
your grandmother end up being born in one of these terrible places?
Yeah, well, basically what happened is her father had been sent there because he was part of a group of students who had a discussion in which they expressed some wrong opinions. Somebody reported them for having these wrong discussions, and he was sent there. And her mother, they were not married at the time or didn't know each other. Her husband was for some reason taken away by the KGB, and she never heard anything from him again. And when she left her baby with a neighbor and went to inquire to the KGB after her husband. And as she was getting to the door of this building, it wouldn't have been the KGB, it would have had a different name at the time, but it was the same thing. The woman who met her, she said, "Do not go in there, no one comes out." But she wanted so much to find out what happened to her husband, she went inside anyway, and lo and behold, she ended up in the camp as well. Never heard from her husband again, and that's how people lived. Your husband gets taken away, you leave your baby with a neighbor, you get taken away to a camp. And she ended up in this camp. She met my grandmother's father, and they had they basically got together there and had a child in the camp. And the only reason they were really able to do that is her father was he was a very skilled engineer, highly trained engineer, and so he was useful. He wasn't like part of the gen pop. He had he had his own I think he even had his own house at one point that was actually physically outside the camp, where they would stay in the evenings, and they had some guards there, but it was almost like they were free. Whereas most people would have to stay in the camp. So that's how they ended up. And it was a period of time during which that was a pretty common story. People just being taken away in the middle of the night. If you've read Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, he talks about, why the people who did this were able to do this to the populace, because he talked about how when these cars turned up outside an apartment block, what they should have been met with is everybody in that building with knives and axes and hunting rifles and whatever, defending their neighbor from being taken away. But instead, people sat and watched their neighbor taken away, be taken away, because they were hoping that it wouldn't happen to them. And it happened to millions of people. They ended up in these camps, and most of them, of course, either didn't make it out or spent, decades, essentially in false imprisonment.
So from a place like this, your family comes to a point where they can send you to a boarding school in the United Kingdom. What was that like?
Well, it was crazy because I didn't speak any English, pretty much. I mean, I thought I spoke some English because I'd studied it, but I wanted to, when I got here, it turned out I couldn't understand anything and couldn't speak very much either. So it was a challenging adjustment for the first couple of years, and I was only, early teens, maybe even before, maybe I was even 11. I can never remember, 11, 13, something like that. And I was basically on my own for at the school where you live and you go to school, and no family. So it was a challenge for sure.
So you have the story of this immigration to this place that now you call home and you love. What are your views on immigration?
Well, I think that a certain amount of immigration, particularly when it's calibrated to the needs of the host society, where you are able to decide who comes and in what form and how many and when and where, you're able to choose the people that enter your country and settle in it. I think it's good. I think it's important. I think it's, if you look at, who's driving a lot of the innovation that happens in society, who's willing to take risks, because, if you get the right people coming in, they're going to be the creme de la creme of their society that they're leaving. They are extremely driven, extremely determined, hardworking, willing to tolerate challenges and difficulties that most of the host population wouldn't do. If you look at the history of the United States, for example, how much of the greatness of America has been built by people coming in from somewhere else and, taking a risk, taking a chance, opening a little restaurant, starting a little business, all of that. I think it can be really healthy. But I also think that countries need borders. And this was a fairly uncontroversial statement until about 2 minutes ago, when some extreme leftist ideologues came along and suddenly decided that, we should, as we do in Britain, just allow people to get on a boat in France and just sail over, not even sail, it's just like a rubber dinghy, go over the English Channel, land on our shores, not be checked for who they are, not have to get a visa, not have to get any permission or follow any of the rules that any legal immigrant has to follow, and then just dissipate into the general population with no sign of their arrival whatsoever, or increasingly be housed by the taxpayer in hotels and be given all the provisions. And likewise in the United States, you know, I don't find it controversial that the southern border, over which millions of people pour into your country without being checked or without being stopped to make sure that they're the people that the American voting public wants in America, I don't think it's controversial to suggest that that's a problem. And the fact that I have to be an immigrant to be able to express that view without being called racist and whatever is another problem. You know, we've got to be able to have sensible conversations about government policy. And immigration changes the nature of the country. It affects social cohesion. It affects the economy. It affects all levels of crime, all sorts of things of that nature that need to be looked at very carefully. And Brad, I say this all the time. And I think this is a really important point to make. You know, whatever my views of immigration is actually irrelevant. What I think is important is what are the views of the British public and the American public when it comes to this issue? And is what they voted for being delivered on the southern border and in the English Channel? And in my opinion, having observed what people voted for and how people express their preferences on this issue, the reason there's a lot of frustration around the issue of immigration in both our countries is that what the people are voting for is not what is being delivered. No one voted to have an open border in the UK or the US, and that is to a large extent what is happening. And that lack of democratic accountability, I think, is a bigger problem than the issue itself.
So for you, as you try to make points, I've noticed that when I see you debate, you have these great skills from your comedy background. How do you kind of warm people up to these ideas?
I don't know that I do. I sometimes think I should do more of that warming up because I'm so keen to get my point across logically and concisely so that the logic and the rationale of it is irrefutable that I actually often forget that I was once a stand-up comedian because I'm now in this space where I'm giving opinions on stuff. So I actually, something I'm always trying to work on is how do I express myself in a way that's easier for people to hear? And I would sort of give myself a B minus on that, if that really. So it's definitely not an area I would brag about.
Well, that's funny because I've watched you and I've noticed that, you know, if you're at a round table with a set of policy folks, it seems that the crowd gets to your side more quickly. It seems that I don't know how you do it. It's, and maybe it's innate, but it seems
well,
you have
no,
a skill
I
for,
just, I just,
for getting
I think
the crowd.
The reason is that I sort of, we live in a world where you started this conversation, which is very politically correct. And if you come along and you just say what you think, honestly, the integrity of the statement alone is quite refreshing. I may be wrong, but at least people know that what I'm saying is what I believe. Whereas if you've got another five people around the same table who are equivocating, obfuscating, not quite saying what they think, pretending that an issue isn't a problem that is a problem, pretending that an issue that other people are pretending that a problem exists when it doesn't, it's important, whatever, then the contrast, I think, is quite striking. I think that really is where that impression comes from. That's why I don't really think I'm doing anything special when I talk about these issues. I just say what I think, and I think the world is so messed up right now that in and of itself is quite striking.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of adventure that you take yourself on when you speak the truth and you put it out there and see what happens. So what do you think is happening with comedy in the West? It's something you say that you used to do.
Well, it depends what you mean by comedy. When I said used to, I used to do stand-up comedy. I don't do stand-up anymore. When the lockdown first happened, I stopped doing it because I had to. And then I kind of looked around and realized that while the practice of doing stand-up and the joy of being on stage is always there and it's always something I enjoy, everything else that comes with the comedian lifestyle was actually having a terrible impact on my life, on my family, etc. And my wife and I just we've got a young son now, and you know, we want to continue expanding the family over time. So it means I have to be around more. I can't, you know, my old schedule, particularly with doing my YouTube show with Francis Trigonometry, takes up so much of my time that I literally, like right now, we've just spent 2 months building our new studio, which required me and the whole team basically working flat out. If I was doing stand up, I literally wouldn't see my family for weeks on end. And that was not working. It's fair to say that my son would never even have existed if I'd continued with the old way of doing things. So moving away personally for me, it has been great. But on trigonometry, we do a lot of we do three raw shows, we call them raw, a week, which are like satirical comedy, current affairs, taking down the stuff that's been happening on that day or that week. And we do those, which is comedic, and there's a lot of comedy involved in that. I also write on my Substack, and sometimes the pieces are satirical. What I put out on social media is often quite satirical, so I'm still doing it. And the truth is, I always sort of half joke when people ask me, because I try not to comment on the world of stand up anymore, because I haven't been in it for, the best part of what, 2 years now. Probably, yeah, about 2 years. In fact, would we be, is it nearly 3 years now? Because the first lockdown happened in January, well, not in March 2020. So then March 2023 will be 3 years. So it's almost 3 years. Wow, man, that's insane. Yeah. So I haven't done stand up. I haven't been in that world for 3 years. So I am sure, Brad, you and your listeners will agree with me that in that time, there's no doubt the entire comedy industry has been transformed, and it's no longer obsessed about, people having the right opinions, and lots of comedians are taking risks and pushing back against the dominant cultural narrative of our time. And I'm certain that, all of that is going on, and comedians aren't being excluded from comedy clubs and banned from venues as they were only a short while ago for having the wrong jokes or the wrong opinions. I'm sure no one's getting outraged on the internet about jokes. I'm sure all of that no longer happens, as woke comedians keep telling me. So yeah, hopefully that's true. I somehow don't believe it, but who am I to comment?
Well, I did see that you went to Austin, Texas. You checked out the club that Joe Rogan started up. What did you see there? Did it give you hope, or was it maybe just a flash in the pan?
Well, no, this is the one thing I realized out of our American trip, is while of course similar trends are happening in both the US and the UK, in terms of comedy and censorship of comedy and restrictions in comedy and one political viewpoint dominating all others and trying to force them out of existence within that comedy industry, actually the US isn't nearly as far gone, and there are powerful enough players there that it can create a counter movement. Joe Rogan is obviously a good example of this, but there are others, Andrew Schultz, Tim Dillon, Mark Norman, Tyler Fisher. I could go on. There's a lot of people in the guy who does Kill Tony Hinchcliffe, a bunch of them, who are able to create comedy and continue to do stand-up because there's different scenes in America. You can start your own scene. If you're Joe Rogan, you just move to Austin, open up a club, you get comedians coming through, someone else is going to open up another club, and before you know it, it's going to grow. In the UK, that's not how it works, because there's one comedy scene, and if you are considered the wrong person or to have the wrong opinions in that scene, that's it. So America is nowhere near as far gone. And yeah, at Joe's Club, I mean, it was pretty wild. It was a wild, wild place. And I am not actually someone who is even that big a fan of like the most offensive comedy. I think it should be possible to do. I personally don't enjoy it as much as other people, but it was awesome seeing it be done, because in the UK, it's like that would never happen.
And you mentioned starting a counter movement. I wonder, what do you think a positive counter movement in the West would look like, given the sort of dominant narrative right now?
Bingo. That is the billion-dollar question. And I've been talking to all sorts of people about it. I'm trying to get people privately for now to just start thinking about that issue in my space. Other comedians, musicians, political figures, people who have audiences and influence and whatever. And the question I'm asking all of them is like, look, we know what we're against. We know what we're against. We think the extremes of wokeness are idiotic. We also increasingly think the extremes of anti-wokeness are idiotic, right? These are two extremes that are having this bitch fest. What about those of us who are the sensible 80% in the middle? What And what do we have to offer the world other than criticism of these two extremes? What is it that we stand for? What is it that we believe in? What is it that we consider important? What is it that we can unite around? Because that's also an issue. Because, you know, if you look at people who, I don't want to say anti-woke because I don't want to put myself or anyone in that box, but the people who've spoken out against the extremes of progressive dogma, it's a coalition of anti-authoritarian liberals like me, liberals in the traditional sense, not in the American, you know, mental leftist sense, and right of center people who are conservatives, and those people will often disagree about stuff. So I think the questions that we got to start asking is, what are we for? What do we have to offer the world? And I don't have a shopping list of things to go here, Brad. There's 10 things that we must all suddenly start to do. The one thing that I recognize, and you know, this is the new father in me speaking, is I think having children is a very big, important part of that. If you think about the fact that we live in societies in which young people increasingly delay, defer, or abstain from having kids, that can't, if you were to just look at it as, forget that we're human beings, forget that we're as a civilization, just look at it as an animal. Imagine you came across a species of animals who for some reason were not having offspring because of some psychological and practical things that are happening in their environment. Would you conclude that that is a healthy species? Right? You probably wouldn't. And so that is something that people, I think, should be concerned about. And look, you can have any opinion you want. You can have any policy you want about that. The fact is, people need to take that into their own hands and have children. You know, so I think the people, particularly who are in the sensible middle, who haven't bought into either extreme, you've got to have kids and make sure that they are equipped to deal with the world critically and not absorb all the rubbish that they're being fed at school and university and whatever, that they're able to analyze things for themselves. And the other thing that ties into this, and this applies whether you think the issue of climate change is the doomsday scenario that Greta Thunberg wants you to believe, and we've got 12 good harvests left and we need to blah, 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 or whether you don't believe that, irrespective of which of those points of view you take, the net zero and what we are trying to do to deal with the issue of climate change is completely moronic. It will never solve that problem for reasons I actually did a debate at the Oxford Union recently. It was formally on the issue of woke culture, but I talked more about this issue because I'm tired of talking about woke culture, really. But the point is that the West has almost no control over the issue of climate because we don't produce the overwhelming majority of the emissions in the world. And so the only way that the West can truly meaningfully impact that issue is by creating new technology and making scientific progress that allows us to make cheaper and cleaner energy that poor people in other parts of the world will actually use, right? That's how you solve that problem. And making Westerners poorer, making sure that grannies freeze in Britain in winter and die of the cold as they do in the thousands because we decided to be to pretend to be green, right? Because this is what we do. We don't produce our own coal, we import it from somewhere else, as if producing coal in China makes it better, makes it cleaner. Well, it doesn't. It actually makes it dirtier. So the illogicality of that issue means that what we have to do is encourage our young people to think of themselves as potential sources of a solution, because they are. The solution to the issue of climate, the solution to the issue of resource depletion, all of that is technological. It is to invent and come up with technology and make scientific breakthroughs that will enable humanity to flourish in the face of this new challenge. The one thing people, it pisses me off, Brad, I'll be honest with you, because the arrogance, the sheer utter arrogance to think that we are the first generation of people in the history of our species who cannot solve their own problems. It's astounding to me that we believe that we're the first people, having evolved through to thousands of generations of people who had far more pressing problems, far more difficult problems, that in the context of what they were doing, right? The issue of going from being a hunter-gatherer society to being an agrarian society, the issue from a pre-industrial society to an industrial society, the transformations that occurred during this period of time were so, so difficult to deal with for humanity that they pale into insignificance compared to everything we're dealing with now. Given the technological progress we've already made, climate change is a much easier issue to solve in the way that I'm talking about than many of the issues humanity has faced in the past. How do you make sure your citizens don't starve to death every year and die from, preventable disease? That has been a universal constant. And yet in the West, we've largely solved it. Much more significant and much more challenging than the stuff that we're dealing with now. And so this arrogance of particularly young people, and it's not their fault because they've been brainwashed by an education system that's been telling them for 50 years the world's about to collapse. When I was at school, we were going to run out of oil, 20 years ago from today. We're going to run out of coal very shortly, etc. But we're not, right? So we've been fed this narrative of passivity, incompetence, we can't deal with this, we just got to make ourselves poorer, we're guilty because we were the ones who created and enjoyed the benefits of the Industrial Revolution. Well, guess what? The Chinese want the Industrial Revolution too, and so do the Indians, and they're not going to not have one because people in the West feel guilty. So we've got to solve that problem. We got to stop looking at that issue as poor me, poor us, the world's about to end, we need to stop. Britain produces 2% of global carbon emissions. That includes the emissions that we outsource to other countries. We could sink into the sea tomorrow. It would make no difference to the issue of climate change. But if we can come up with a technology that makes energy cheaper and cleaner, we can solve it. And so, I think part of the answer is we've got to have more kids. And the other thing is we've got to teach them, guys, this is your problem. Solve it. Go to Oxford, go to Cambridge, go to Stanford, go to MIT, study science, and solve it, fix it. That's what human beings have done for thousands of generations in the past. You're not more pathetic, even though you look it, than the previous generations, right? Solve it, solve it. And my generation needs to do that, and older people need to do that. That we gotta have a solution-oriented approach to that issue, and to many others, and solve it to the extent that it's possible, and deal with it and cope with it to the extent that it's not possible. That is our job. Let's stop having Extinction Tantrum or whatever these groups call themselves, throw paint and throw soup on paintings and block roads and prevent ambulances from getting to hospitals. Let's solve the problem. Let's solve the problem. You want to take it seriously? Cool. That means you've got to go and study for 4 years and get your degree, and then you've got to get your postgraduate, and then you've got to get your PhD, and then you've got to spend 20 years in a lab, and you may 30 years down the line contribute one small piece of the massive puzzle of solving that problem. But you know what? That's hard, Brad. That takes time. That takes energy. That takes money. That takes dedication. That takes intellect. And it's much easier to sit on social media and tweet about stuff or to put yourself on the road between you and a hospital. Doesn't solve the problem, though. So a positive vision for the future, having kids, those are the two things I think we've got to start with. And then on top of that, you're going to build a lot of other stuff that everyone will have their own view on.
Excellent. Well, Konstantin Kissin, before I ask my last question, where should folks look for you online?
I'm on all the social media. Just Google me, Konstantin Kissin. And of course, check out Trigonometry, which is the YouTube channel I co-host with Francis Foster. It's two comedians interviewing very interesting people from politics, media, culture, etc. And we also, as I said, do three raw shows a week, which is two comedians taking the piss of everything, that all the craziness that's happening in the world.
Great. We'll put links
and of course, my Substack as well.
Yes. And we'll put links to all of that in the description for folks to check out. And my final question is, what do you think people can do to remind themselves of the value of Western culture?
Look around. Travel to other places. Go to a poor country. Just go and see it for yourself. If you haven't traveled, you should not be allowed to comment on how bad the West is. Go and see how people live. Go and see how people, and you don't have to go to sub-Saharan Africa either. Go to Central Europe. It's a part of the civilized world. Look how people live in a village in Hungary. Look how people live in a village in Russia or in a village in Ukraine. Look how people live in India. Look how people live in China. These are not, you know, Russia, China, Ukraine. These are middle-income countries. Look how some people live over there, and then compare it to your own life. And then we can talk about how bad, how, you know, the situation is economically or in whatever other way. Gratitude, the easiest way to get gratitude is to see that other people don't have things as good as you do. And we are extraordinarily privileged. You know, people love to talk about male privilege, white privilege, all this other stuff. The truth is, the biggest privilege in the world is Western privilege that we all enjoy. Once you have something to compare it to, it becomes very difficult to take it for granted.
Well, Konstantin, thank you for sharing that and your message and for spending your time with me. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Brad, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for watching this episode. To help get more great guests on the show, be sure to subscribe.